Major League Baseball. It's showtime.
I don't know about you, but I am ready to play some baseball after that song.
Woo!
And by play some baseball, I mean grab a video game remote and try hitting with Chuck Knoblauch. Because that man had the smallest strike zone in that game. Because he would crunch down and was all 3 feet 6 inches. And it was the best.
He basically had the Phil Plantier batting stance. Where it was like I'm going to pretend like I'm taking a poop and scare you as a pitcher, but I'm actually going to jack it out of the park.
I just didn't know anybody that could squat for so long and then swing a bat effectively.
Yeah, right? And especially his body structure, too, because he was 90% upper body, and his tiny little pencil legs were sitting there holding him up, and yeah.
That's true.
He would yak the ball.
And he wasn't like a Jeff Bagwell, where you could tell that guy was like, he had like 2 stools. For legs. I mean, when he was jacking the ball, that was, I think, one of the only batters that had a back step when he hit the ball rather than a forward step, because his stance was so wide, he actually had to back step to hit the ball rather than forward step or whatever. Yeah. Crazy.
Well, after that fun intro, welcome to Pop Not Soda, episode 17.
17, Allison's favorite baseball player, Darren Erstedt.
Okay.
There you go.
Yeah.
Shout out to Allison and Darren Erstedt.
Only shout out to Darren Erstedt in his career.
I mean, I think you could probably.
Is he still scouring the internet for shout outs?
He's been waiting. He's been waiting for this moment.
Oh, and well, I hope he finds us. As you have found us on either our site, popnotsoda.podbean.com, or on pointandyell.com. It's like our second week there now.
We're officially in our second week of production right
yes.
now.
Yes, and because we're official, we have a wonderful guest joining us tonight.
We needed to legitimize this a little bit. Ladies and gentlemen, we have the very special Greg Atkinson on the air.
I am the way you guys legitimize this. Yes. This thing is going down fast. Let me just say that right now.
If this were a literal ship, I believe.
This is the Titanic of all podcasts right here. That's
starting off. Is that an iceberg ahead? Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Screw it. Whatever.
Yeah. This is how we drew it up.
I'm glad to be here, guys. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you, brother.
Yes.
Glad to have you.
Again, so I'm Dan, Brett, Brian, how are you guys doing? How were your weekends?
It was good. I didn't do too much. I hung out, stayed out in LA. It was good.
no hell.
Any weekend not in LA.
Yeah, that was a good weekend. Yeah.
Brian?
Well, the birthday onslaught started for me last weekend, so hit 2 birthday parties. Oh. And yeah, parents were getting busy.
Nice. And
whatever 9 months, you know, probably October, November.
Yeah.
Because I got about 5 birthday parties in a row.
1-year-olds?
No, like adult.
Oh, adult! I thought parents were getting busy and having babies.
Just like 28 years ago.
He was actually in the room while this was happening.
But Cheer him on!
I also
enjoyed
that's
a party.
I also enjoyed crashing 1-year-old birthday parties as well. So another hobby of mine.
Tim and Chuck Knopf.
I called Chuck. I'm like, hey.
They cruise around, and when they spot a bouncy house, got it going.
Kid, this is how you jack home runs in 20 years.
That's right.
Yeah. And you know what? I bet you, if Chuck Knoblauch is standing in line with the kids, he's the same height.
That's right. That's
absolutely. Right. And then we text Darren Erstedt, wish you were here, sucker.
Wow, they're working off to a bang, boys. We're as legitimate as it gets right now. Yeah.
Chuck Knoblauch and Darren Erstedt just fire on all cylinders.
That's throwing concrete.
I don't know out of the 7 listeners if they are very versed in late 90s baseball names and stars, But if you are, you're really enjoying this right now.
Yeah, somebody's licking their chops right now. Right.
Finally! Yeah.
This is the podcast for me. Sun Knoblock and Darren Erskine.
That podcast. we need to think about changing our name, actually.
Okay. Yeah. Well, speaking of sports, there's a shit ton going on right now. We've got the NHL Stanley Cup Finals, which a game is going on tonight, which I think at the last time I checked, the Blackhawks were in the lead. But they're down in the series 2-1. And again, I think I've said this maybe 5 episodes ago. If you're not a hockey fan, the NHL playoffs are the most exciting thing on TV. Because you don't have to care about any team. You just watch a bunch of guys hit each other and score a lot of goals, and it's exciting.
And especially, it's a brutal sport.
Yeah, especially this series, because it's not like there's a lot of possession of the puck, and then they wait and they shoot. It's literally, one team goes down, throws the puck to the net. If it doesn't go in, the other team gets in, goes right back down. It's like a ping pong match.
This actually reminds me of my college years. There was a whole lot of puck throwing around and guys hitting each other, but not much else going on. You know what I mean? Yeah. They're like I'm not a big hockey fan for the simple fact that I don't understand it. I'm the type of guy that if you're watching a sport and you don't understand it, I'm that guy. With hockey, I don't get it. Also soccer, so if there's any FIFA soccer fans in here, the only thing I know is somebody's getting paid. Other than that,
well, you know,
I'm
leaving my own show. That's what I'm doing. I'm leaving our show. I'm done.
you talk about soccer or hockey, I'm out. Sorry, I'm the best guest ever. I think
scratching FIFA off the
officially off the points list this week. No, but I think Greg brings up a great point, and that's something that we are seeing in hockey that hasn't been seen in a long time, is it's becoming a full contact sport, where there was this period in probably mid-90s for about a decade or so, where hits were really like minimal,
right?
And you didn't see people really playing full contact. This is a good sport to watch now.
I'll tell you why. That's because in the late 80s, 90s, you had what were called goons, and they were probably the only real physical players, because their whole purpose in the sport was to protect the star player, make sure they didn't get picked on, and if they got hit, fight the guy that hit.
Yes, I see. Now that's the hockey I remember back in the good old days.
Yeah,
you know the what I call the Gretzky era. You know what I mean? Back when those guys were hitting each other and going hard at it. And don't get me wrong, I watched a lot of the reason I referenced the college days is because I watched a lot of hockey in college, because in NCAA there was a lot of great checks, but not a lot of fights. Okay, mm-hmm. So in other words, guys were hitting each other legitimately in the course of the game. But the game continued, and it wasn't these, you know, 20-minute lulls, and you got to wait on them to separate the fight, and this and that. And then the NHL got away from good, clean hits, and it just got to where if guys were going to hit each other, they ended up fighting. And now you've got big dead moments in the game, and I quit watching.
And it was dirty. I mean, there was a lot of dirty players made their money in the 90s. But now what they've moved away from is there's a lot less fights and a lot more free-flowing gameplay. And with that, you just get a ton of hits. Like, one of the Anaheim Duck games that went into overtime, they had, in the first period, they had 30 hits. Just one team. I think had 25 hits was what it was. And that's ridiculous for any amount of hits. Like, I think the opposing team had 9.
Well, and you see these hits happen too, and it's not like a subtle bump or anything. These people are getting smashed in the plexiglass, and their face is like getting morphed into the plexiglass.
I'll tell you this though, but the plexiglass holds you up, so it's not as bad.
It's actually better for you.
And when you're closer to the boards, you know you're probably going to get hit. You brace yourselves. The worst hits are open ice.
Open ice.
Especially if you have your head down, you should expect to get leveled.
You know, when you think about that too, an open ice check is probably the biggest display of strength in sports these days, because you're not on a stable ground, and that person is legitimately just dropping you without having their feet in place.
I have accidentally fallen on ice, and it doesn't feel good. I don't want to be put there by a 220-pound man, okay?
Right.
That just, nothing about that sounds fun to me.
I'd probably open ice check myself against Greg if I ran into
him. You would need a lot of momentum, Greg. Okay.
What happened to Brett? Oh,
yeah, you know what?
Greg, it's fine.
Yeah. And Brett's eating his food through a straw for the next 2 months. Yeah. But not only in the Stanley Cup.
Way too much credit. I appreciate it. I may look big, but it's all soft. I'm filled with pillows. It's fine.
Brett just gets absorbed.
That's right.
This is soft and cuddly.
He's like, I just hit a Tempur-Pedic. This is nice. All right.
not only are the Stanley Cup Finals going on, and again, I will preach until hockey is over this season that you should watch it because it's amazing.
I think what's cool, too, really quick, is you're seeing the closet fans come out of hockey, too. CM Punk, things like that. I don't think CM Punk's ever been a closet hockey fan.
No, not at all.
But you're seeing a lot of celebrities now that are coming out of the woodwork. It's kind of like NASCAR a little bit, where people are like...
Don't ever compare hockey to NASCAR.
Okay, I'm
sorry.
Yeah,
so NASCAR, there's real athletes.
So what I'm saying...
They're going to sit for 2 hours straight.
Done! It's 10 minutes and I'm done.
So what I'm saying, though, is basically you're seeing a lot of people that were like, I didn't really have anybody to talk about hockey about. Now that it's a popular sport, I can go on the air and just say, like, hey, I like hockey. This is my team or whatever. You're seeing a lot of more people do that these days, celebrity high-caliber actors.
Well, there also hasn't been a strike every 3 years. We've done, like, 5 years without a strike.
Right.
So that's or a lockout. So
yeah.
That's good.
Yeah.
Because we have Gary Bettman is the most corrupt commissioner that's not ahead of FIFA.
Yeah, I was going to say,
that's not the
I'm glad you clarified that, because there for a minute it was about to be an argument.
FIFA needs to be a stipulation on any...
Yeah, there's always an asterisk.
I mean, I don't even think Bernie Madoff is as corrupt as FIFA is.
You know, I think he might actually be their accountant. I'm not sure. I'm pretty sure he might be their accountant.
He's actually jealous of how much they got away with. Because Bernie Madoff never had an apartment for his cats in the Trump Tower.
Oh, God, right?
Other than the NHL Stanley Cup Finals, there's another Finals going on, which has been nerve-wracking for, I think, two very desperate fan bases. Because Cleveland and Golden State, they haven't seen championships. I mean, I'm counting Golden State as where they play in Oakland. They haven't seen championships in 40 to 50 years. And
it's the Bay Area.
No, I'm not going to give them credit.
Okay.
Right now.
Yeah,
right
they don't get the benefit of the doubt included in that.
Yeah, like the Giants have won. That's good for them if you like the Giants. But when it comes to basketball, they haven't won since Rick Barry. And they are desperate. These finals are exciting, and they are probably some of the sloppiest basketball I've ever seen.
It's street
absolutely.
Ball. It looks like street ball.
Yeah. It is messy.
I mean, I would say a majority of possessions are just one-on-one games. Steph Curry on Golden State and LeBron James on Cleveland.
Who do I match up with?
Right. And in scenarios where the teams have leads, they kind of just fall out of the play style that gets them to those leads. So with Cleveland, you have LeBron holding the ball, sitting around until the shot clock's at 5 seconds, him trying to do some crazy shit, jacking up a shot that is contested and is terrible, and he should have passed the ball. And with Steph Curry, you have 15 screens set for him in the span of 24 seconds. And, you know, for the most part, he'll make the shot.
Yeah.
But he, you know, should rely on his other teammates and, you know, moving the ball, which I think is the reason why they scored so many points and, you know, outscored their competition more than any other team in the league this year.
I think it's interesting you bring that up, because both teams were talked about their teamwork getting to this point. You know what I mean? How nobody expected Cleveland to be here, because really the only person they had name-wise was, and I did do air quotes for those of you who can't see me, it was...
Great radio.
Yeah, exactly. By the way. Was LeBron. I mean, he was the name, yeah. You know what I mean? And so then the next thing you know, JR stepped up. And then, you know, and these guys started coming in and helping out. Now some of those guys are hurt. And now LeBron's kind of starting to feel that pressure, I think, of, hey, I've got to step back into this role because the guys that were helping me out are now hurt and fading away. But it is interesting, because you're right. When the teams get down to it, it ends up being LeBron against Steph. And Steph, 12 seconds in last night's game, they give Steph the ball. They're down, I don't know, 8 points or whatever. They set 4 screens for him at the top of the key.
And they still can't guard him.
And they still, and they put a guy in his face, and he goes around 1 screen, 2 screen, 3 screen, 4 screen, jacks it up, and it goes in. And it's like, you know, they're both very talented guys, but I really think you're right. I think both teams need to play good team basketball, and uh, I I think that's who's going to end up winning the series.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure Steve Kerr set a screen on that play, too.
I think so. I really do. Yeah. He actually put on an old uniform.
Or was it Luke Walton?
No. Oh, God.
Oh, Luke Walton. I don't think Luke Walton can do shit for basketball.
He does look great on the sideline. That's his
I don't think Luke Walton set a screen when he was actually on the sideline. That's the problem.
Luke Walton is great at one thing, and it's because he played with Kobe, and that's passing the ball.
Yes.
Yeah.
Or sitting on the bench.
No, I'm legitimately, no. He's a great passer.
He touches the ball a lot, yeah.
And one thing I want to cover quickly.
God, I would love to be a professional NBA basketball player and have somebody go, yeah, hey, you dished the ball really well your entire career. You know, you're really accurate at
exposing those lines. Yeah,
this category for it is called assists.
Great job.
Oh, man.
You know, the funny thing I hear about people talk about professional sports, they're like, man, I really feel bad for that guy that just sits at the end of the bench and doesn't get called on a lot. Really? Because he's
that's my dream job.
He's making more than I am in 5 years. Please, put me at the end of the bench in a jersey and never call my name.
Yeah, backup long snapper.
I've got the best seat in the house for sports.
Absolutely. The best position in sports is third string quarterback.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Third string quarterback. But speaking about LeBron taking shots, I will say I see your point about Steph Curry going against LeBron, but I think it's a testament that in the past two games, other than like the last minute 30, Steph Curry could not find a shot. And the fact is, Golden State had suffered it. And it wasn't like Steph Curry wasn't getting open looks. It's just simply the fact that he wasn't making those shots. And people can credit Matthew Dellavedova's defense, because statistics have been proving that the Warriors are plus 21 without him on the floor and negative 28 when Matthew Dellavedova is on the floor. Which, all he is a hustle dude that's getting great lucky breaks. Like, the and one bank shot he had yesterday down the key after Steph hit a three was lucky, amazing, and he hit the free throw, which is all props to him, because he looks like a guy that you play pickup basketball with and you don't want to be near because you're going to get hurt because he's out of control. But there was a funny thing I read about called, there's a statistic that people are trying to get called the Kobe assist. And the Kobe assist is when a missed shot actually turns out to be beneficial for the team.
Right.
So it's not, so like with LeBron, he's shooting a high volume of shots because that's where their offense is now, that they're depending on him, because there's no Kyrie Irving, there's no Kevin Love, there was no Iman Shumpert for half the game yesterday. I mean, the starting lineup he had at the beginning of the season was completely different last night, except for LeBron James. That when he takes a shot and he misses, Tristan Thompson is there, grabs a great rebound, and can put it back in. Or Timothy Mozgov gets a tip dunk. And that's only created by the offense and the attention paid to LeBron when he's shooting the shot. There's no other way to get the ball down in that area other than putting it up.
No.
And they tribute Kobe, and that's why it's called the Kobe assist, because that's what a lot of players like Powell, like Dwight Howard, when they played with Kobe, could get a lot of points on.
Now, I can see that. I could see that happening, and I could see that working for teams to their benefit in a very, very specific context. But if you continue to do that as an organization year in and year out, you're going to exhaust your players that aren't the number one stars, and they will not want to play with you, you know, after a few years, after the championships have not been ascertained by that by your organization.
Well, case in point, look at LA. Look at the Lakers.
Yeah.
I mean, they are now a worn-out shell of what they used to be, and the one guy that is the face of the franchise is always broken.
Yeah.
You know, because he was always their starting point for the offense. He was the guy that would get the shot up so everybody else could get their tip backs or whatever else. And after a while, it takes a toll.
Yeah.
And it gets to a point where, you know, it will wear a team down. And if that's what you base your team around, you're absolutely right. I agree with you. I think that after a while, you're going to break everybody down. You're going to break the system down, and then you got to restart from the beginning.
Yeah, yeah.
One, I've never been happier at the Lakers' misfortune, so there's that. But two, we are one shot away from Cleveland being up 3-0 because they had the last possession in game one, and they could have made the shot if, you know.
And by they,
it's LeBron.
Do you mean LeBron James?
But it is very different because they're only in this situation because of injuries. This would be a completely different series if you were full strength Cleveland versus the Golden State Warriors.
And I think the sport of basketball itself has that specific exploit that you can't really apply to a lot of other sports in general. You can't really have a one-man team, but in NBA, it actually works out a lot in your favor. But that's what I'm saying back to, it's going to exhaust all the supportive players that are in those supporting roles that are going, wait, my stats aren't beating this. Like, what am I doing to actually increase my worth as a player rather than just supporting somebody that's going to bring us a ring?
And let's face it, that's the very reason that LeBron left Cleveland in the first place.
Exactly.
That is the very reason that LeBron said, you know what, I'm going to crap on the city that loves me and the city I'm supposed to be for, and I'm going to go down to, you know, to Florida and play with two other guys that can help win me a ring.
Yeah.
Because doing it by himself was finding to be very difficult, virtually impossible. And so he said, well, I'll go get my ring and then I'll come back to a city like the coward I am. But I would never dog on LeBron James, even though he's, you know, overrated. But, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah. Well, I think that's an interesting debate, though, that was brought up, though. What we were discussing before is, now, how much of a dick can you actually be as a great athlete before, you know, before people start melding your skills and your character together and going, you know, I don't like that guy. Regardless of what they've done, I do not like that guy.
Well, there's a lot of room.
Yeah, exactly.
Michael Jordan,
huge dick, but everybody loves him.
Yeah,
because he's the greatest basketball player of all time.
There it is. I heard that. That wasn't LeBron that he was talking about. I just want to point that out.
No one should ever argue. There are people in sports which should never have an argument against. Michael Jordan, Wayne Gretzky, two examples. And any argument with that, you can go back and forth every day, so I'm not gonna touch that. I'm not a LeBron fan at all. But in the defense of LeBron James, one, nobody would want to play with that 2007 roster because his next best players are Larry Hughes and
Ildowski. Is Larry Hughes even playing anymore?
No. Yeah. Larry Hughes is probably selling shoes at a Foot Locker.
Was Mo Williams on that team?
He was not.
He was not on that team.
I looked up this roster today. And I kind of disagree with you, Brett, because I think people love playing with LeBron because when people play with LeBron, their stats go up. When he leaves, they drop tremendously. Matthew Dellavedova would not be in the position. J.R. Smith would not have the open threes. Timothy Mozgov would be irrelevant like he was on the Knicks because I bet you didn't know that Denver drafted him then traded him with the Carmelo trade and went to New York. Didn't work.
Disappeared.
Yeah.
So then New York drafted him, I'm so sorry. Then what's the difference? So then what's the difference between how Cleveland is running it compared to how L.A. has destroyed their organization?
They haven't destroyed. Well, it's Kobe injured. Uh-huh. It's the lack of draft picks because they weren't building from young talent. What they were doing, they were trading for already named superstars.
That had hence no buy-in Pau in their Gasol, organization.
Hence Steve Nash, hence Dwight Howard. People who were already made, who weren't on long-term contracts, who weren't cheap. Mm-hmm. And when you pay your superstar $25 million, which is almost half of the cap room, it doesn't leave you with a lot of room to do what Miami did, where Bosch, Wade, and LeBron took pay cuts to play with each other. People want to go play with LeBron. People don't want to play with Kobe. Even though I would say Kobe probably has the better superstar mentality over LeBron because LeBron's more selfless when it comes to playing basketball.
I want to point out, too, I cannot, as we discussed earlier, I cannot disrespect LeBron's abilities. He is a very talented young man. I do respect his abilities. My issues are some of the things that he's done off the court or not in a basketball relation. You know, like dancing when you're up 50 points on the sideline, or you know, holding an hour press conference to tell a city that's been behind you and is supposed to be your beloved city that you're going to poop on them and head down to Florida. Those things are the issues that I have with LeBron. I think in his later years, in the last even 3, 4, 5 years, he has gotten a good PR person who has told him, hey, knock that stuff off because you look like an idiot. And he has greatly improved in the last 3 years. But I think his early years in the league, and I do get it, he came in as a kid. But at some point, when you're 3 years in as a veteran, sure, you're a veteran that's 21 years old, but somebody needs to grab you by the arm, pull you to the side, and say, hey, knock this crap off.
Shake the shit out of you.
You look like an idiot, and you're making us look like an idiot. And that's not okay. And that's, you know, those are the issues I have with LeBron. His talent is not to be disputed. I mean, the guy is obviously talented. Anybody who's watched him play with a basketball knows he's talented. But I think it goes back to your original question.
that's the point where I drew the line in the sand and said, no, I'm not going to like this guy because I think he's a jerk. I think he has no respect for the game, and that's that.
Yeah.
Well, I think it just comes down to winning at the end of the day. You know, Kobe had – the Lakers and Kobe had their run. They were in the Western Conference Finals. Yeah, they were winning championships year after year. And I think that's where LeBron is now. I mean, you obviously can't deny the fact that he's been to five straight NBA Finals. And I think that is a big weight on players' decisions to go and play with him. Okay, maybe my stats suffer, but I know I'm going to be in the NBA Finals.
Right.
LeBron James is going to take me to the NBA Finals. Maybe I'm not going to make as much money. Maybe I'm not going to score as many points. Maybe I'm not going to make the All-Star team. But I know I'm going to have a legitimate chance to win the trophy. And hopefully that should be every player's, you know, desire at the end of the day. It's not the paychecks, it's not the endorsements, it's not the publicity, it's the fact that you are playing a game to win. You want to be the best at what you do, so you want to put yourself in a position to do that. How am I going to do that? I'm going to go play with the best player on the planet.
So you think the incentivization is more on those people getting into the winning organizations then at that point?
I do, personally.
Yeah, I mean, that actually makes sense, because there's a monetary gain to, I mean, essentially everybody involved.
The testament to that is Mike Miller.
That's a great point.
He was, I guess, a star role player, is, I guess, the best way to describe him, in Memphis. Towards the end of his career, goes to Miami, wins two championships there, and he was integral in a couple of their wins, hitting big shots. Really has nothing left, but will still follow LeBron and will still throw his body, even though it breaks down left and right, to try and win. And it's because he trusts in LeBron's selfless play and the fact that he knows he's playing with the one person who has the most opportunity to overcome odds by themselves in the NBA.
Yeah. LeBron. They put Mike Miller in the game last night to inbound the ball, to literally just throw the ball to LeBron.
Right.
To literally just throw him the ball.
I mean, he dove for a ball last night. I was like, oh, God, Mike Miller's going to break everybody's body.
Yeah.
And
it's like Samuel L. Jackson from Unbreakable. It's like, just don't do it. Just don't do it.
Please. Please. Last right
just
now.
Drink your milk on the sideline, Mike.
Please, just don't do it.
Keep your jersey on.
But these things come in waves. I mean, you know, in the mid-90s, it was Jordan and the Bulls, and you know, everybody wanted to go play with them and win championships. And then when Kobe came along, everybody wanted to go to L.A., and that's why everybody from Shaquille O'Neal to Nash to Dwight Howard, these guys went to L.A.,
yep.
You know, and now it's you know, LeBron. And guys are going to, you know, it's like bugs to a flame, moths to a flame. Yep, they're going to go to where the best chance to win that ring is, because that is the ultimate prize.
Yeah.
They want to get that ring.
I think the funniest thing at the end of the day, too, is the fact that they're recruiting people to Cleveland, Ohio. Like, I mean, like, how do you sell that to somebody that makes a ton of money, just lives beyond their means in every single way possible, and then you're like, yeah, Miami, you might not want Miami, you might not want L.A.,
I got this.
Cleveland, Ohio.
I got this. You ready? Now, yep. Being a Midwest boy,
being
from Bloomington, Indiana, I got you, okay? I'm just right down the street, okay? This is how we sell that. Listen, LeBron. All right, listen up, buddy. You can go down to South Beach, but here's what's going to happen. Your game's going to suffer, okay? And I'll tell you why. There's too many distractions. You can be in the sun every day. There's going to be gorgeous women walking everywhere, okay? You got kids, you got a wife, you got things to worry about here. You need to be focused on basketball. And when you're in Cleveland, son, that's what we're focused on. We're focused on LeBron James winning championships. Now, in the off season, you want to go get warm, you're making enough money, you can have a beach house wherever you want. But when it's basketball season, you need to be somewhere where you can focus on basketball. Why not be where the game was created? Right here in Ohio.
Well, I'm going to go book a plane ticket to Cleveland. while
Southwest
I do,
or United?
Definitely Southwest, because bads fly free. So while I do that, let's take a break. We'll come back with an exclusive interview with Mr. Greg Atkinson, and we have, as always, your most looked forward to segment, Brian's employed movie review of Fast 7, and I swear to God, if you make fun of Paul Walker, I will attack you, Brian.
First off, it's Fast and Furious 7.
There no, will be a
fast seven. It's just, all right. We're going to break. We will see you, as Brett says, on the flip side.
Stay tuned for the fight. That's right, everybody. You recognize that sound. That's the sound from the old podcast that I used to co-host with Brian Shores. And guess what, everybody? He's having a roast on June 24th at the Navajo Inn. That's right. It's Ryan Shores. He's a degenerate. He's a comedian. He's a beer drinker.
He's a friend.
He's a friend. And I love him dearly. Yeah, everybody, he's playing June 24th at the Navajo Live, 8515 Navajo Road, San Diego, California. Show starts at 8, probably ends around 10, but we all know it's going to end around 12:30. It's going to be a bunch of comedians roasting Ryan Shores, so it's going to be a good show. Check it out, the Navajo Live, June 24th, the roast of Ryan Shores. 8515 Navajo Road. Be sure to grab your tickets.
And bring your marshmallows. Because it's a roast. And you can roast your marshmallows. I won't be there.
Brian's going to be telling those jokes at Ryan Shores, so please be sure to show up.
There's a reason why he wasn't invited to roast.
Show starts at 8. When him leaving, it ends at 8:10. Yeah.
Brian, when are you going to go on that, though? I really want to know.
What time it is? Saxophone time means movie review time. This week, I'm drinking wine. I don't always drink wine, but when I do, I eat a tuna fish sandwich with the crust cut off. R.I.P. Paul Walker. Because this week, I'm going to be talking about Furious 7, aka Fast 7, aka Fast and Furious 7, aka a huge pile of dog shit. Because this movie sucked. It sucked hard. It sucked a golf ball through a garden hose. Probably twice. In fact, I'm going to say it sucked a sleeve of golf balls through a garden hose. This movie was so bad, it honestly made me feel remorse for the ghost of Paul Walker, because they had to come in after the fact and lay him over on some of these terrible, terrible scenes. And my lord, Paul Walker, you did not deserve the punishment that Justin Lin put you through, because this movie sucked.
Do they have much story, or is there anything to it, or is it just another just blatant blow off of a reproduced sequel of the franchise?
Yeah, so they insert Jason Statham into this movie.
Statham?
Yes.
Wait, Jason Statham's in this?
Yes.
He's the ultimate villain in this one.
As in The Transporter, as in Cranked, as in Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, as in Snitch, as in Spy, as in other movies that he's been in.
Better than Paul Walker's career?
Just maybe a touch. So yeah, they conveniently insert him as the brother of the villain in Fast and Furious 6. This movie essentially is like Fast and Furious 4, 5, and 6 rolled into one, with Jason Statham put on top.
like the pin through the middle.
You have the same characters in all of their same stupid struggles. Vin Diesel can't figure out which wife beater to pair with his dark denim jeans. Paul Walker struggling with
living. That's a horrible struggle.
It is. The struggle's real. You have Paul Walker battling his desire to be a family man with his, natural desire to be a wild anarchist and, go back to his FBI roots with bullets literally flying by his head, which he does say in the movie. He misses the bullets. You have other characters in the movie, Ludacris, Tyrese, who are just showing up.
Oh, I thought you were saying Ludacris, Tyrese. But Ludacris and Tyrese are in this
Ludacris
movie.
Ludacris and Tyrese are two separate people.
I thought giving Tyrese an acting
but Tyrese
job was ludicrous.
Is quite ludicrous.
I'm sorry. Okay. Both of them are in this movie.
Unfortunately, both of them are in this movie. Tyrese is Tyrese. So he's... sustainable for like 10 minutes, and then you just wonder why he was even cast and how he can continue to collect a paycheck. They try and make Ludacris intelligent. They make the world's most sophisticated hacker a hot, multicultural English chick, which of course is right along.
Oh, fits the
throes of realism. Not looking like Edward Snowden at all. They don't even give her glasses. Vin Diesel dies in the movie, I want to say, like 3 or 4 times. Miraculously survives every time. There's a scene at the end of the movie where he's literally dead. He's literally dead. And, what's her name?
I'll tell you.
Michelle Rodriguez, right? Michelle Rodriguez. So she's in the movie again. Her memory is all...
Letty.
Her memory is all messed up, like it has been for the last 5 movies.
Men in Black, they've messed with people's memories in this movie?
Oh, yeah. So she, like, she can't remember, and then she can remember.
She had the wreck, and then she couldn't remember anything. She turned bad, and now she's...
I've only seen 2 Times Too Many by John Singleton, the second one. I haven't seen any of the other ones. Yeah, yeah.
I wish I could have stopped with you, but I have seen every single iteration. Michelle Rodriguez, she is battling with these inner demons of, I kind of remember Vin Diesel, but I also want to be this new person because... I have this new lease on life because I can't remember shit, and like I might have been bad in the past. So she gives this
amazing
big heartfelt
performance.
No, not an amazing performance. She gives a terrible performance, but she gives this heartfelt speech to dead Vin Diesel, and she basically lets him know that she remembers everything. All of her memories returned. Vin Diesel, you're such a great guy, and then he miraculously comes back to life, and he's like, "Took you long enough." This movie was filled with the worst one-liners of all time. It's like if you could think of just the shittiest stereotypical action movie one-liners, this movie contained them all, and then some because it had dead Paul Walker.
Would you compare it to CSI Miami on the one-liners, or is it above CSI Miami?
It's above CSI
Miami.
Oh
my God, yes.
Because at least that... is like that's expected, right?
Wow!
Yeah, you expect the sunglasses to whip off. You expect that corny one-liner. In this movie, you're like hoping, you're praying. Maybe it won't be so bad. Maybe they'll make it funny or original, but no, absolutely not. It is just terrible from beginning to end. The action scenes are, they're okay, but they're predictable. They are formulaic. It's nothing that you haven't seen in the other movies before. In fact, I would say Fast and Furious 6 probably, to me at this point, had the most
original action scenes and the, you know, maybe not the best quality, but like the most entertaining, driving through. I think they were in Brazil, right? In the last one.
That's five.
Wherever they were in the last one. It doesn't even matter. They've been all around the world. They drive fast.
Carmen San Diego.
Yeah, exactly.
Racing.
Obviously. And unfortunately, Vin Diesel makes it through every single one. So, to, you know, basically summarize this movie, stuff happens, they drive fast, Paul Walker survives.
Sorry! The irony.
And, you know, in the end...
That's why we brought you a drink.
Sorry.
Why did we brought you a drink?
I was trying to be good over here, but the irony in that...
Greg was just gritting his teeth like, for like 5 minutes.
He's describing how this movie's going down in flames, I thought, typical Paul Walker. But no, he walks away from it. Yeah. You know.
But in all seriousness, you know, I don't want to make light of Paul Walker's death. You know, he was fine in the movie. Whatever, he did his normal acting chops. There are scenes that you can tell where they CGI his face onto, I believe it was his actual brother who came in and sat in for him. It just looks weird and awkward. And then the whole ending is just like a tribute to Paul Walker, which is cool, but it's just like super corny.
How awkward! I'm sorry. With that, like, so it's his brother that played the
two of them. Both his older and younger brother were body doubles that they CGI'd Paul Walker's face over.
Now, are they actors? Like,
I don't really know. Yeah.
But okay. Apparently, the younger one did very well, made a very good impression.
Yeah,
where they may include him in a part in the next two movies.
Are you kidding? They've announced two movies. Okay.
Well, 8's already in production, isn't it? Yeah. 8's already in production.
I mean, this movie made $1 billion. You can't knock the hustle. The movie makes a lot of money. Of course, they're going to make more. I will say, The Rock might be the largest human being on the face of the earth. Like, the guy is...
ginormous.
Is just huge. There's a particular scene in the movie...
Does he rock bottom somebody?
He does rock bottoms Jason Statham. So here's the thing.
That fight scene was cool.
The fight scene with The Rock was cool. There's a fight scene at the end with Jason Statham and Vin Diesel where they both are wielding dual like wrenches and
pipes. Jason Statham legitimately just breaks off a piece of his crashed car to use as a weapon.
Which is one of the stupidest things I've ever seen in my life. First off, Jason Statham would just wipe the mat with Vin Diesel. And Vin Diesel has a fight with The Rock in one, I believe it's Fast and Furious 5.
Fast 5.
Where he legitimately beats up The Rock and is like going to pound his face in and someone has to run in and stop him. Completely ridiculous. Vin Diesel has a fight with his medium wife beater when he puts it on. That's about the extent of his physical prowess over any human being or inanimate object. Maybe the cross necklace, which he does find in this film. But the movie just is stupid. I mean, it's just such a poor attempt at a sequel to carry on this franchise because it's just regurgitated crap at the end of the day. So quickly before I get to other opinions, I give Fast and Furious 7, whatever you want to call it, 2 out of 5 paychecks. And at this point, particularly Dan, I would love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, Dan, you've been grinning through your teeth through this entire thing, man. What's up?
So, Greg, thanks for being here. I would love to get
more about
you. So, for our listeners who may be unfamiliar with your resume,
why don't you give us a little background on yourself
real quick? You have quite a varied resume, Greg. So, like, let's dabble into,
the intricacies of one Mr. Greg Atkinson.
Sure. Quick rundown. Coming out of high school, decided to go into U.S. military, went Army, was a communications specialist in the Army. Basically, I set up cell towers to connect communications from the front lines to the back lines. And they were mobile cell towers that we could erect quickly and take down quickly and jump forward.
No, you were the one actually building those? Or
not? Well, so we would actually put them up. They were fiberglass,
okay,
with an antenna on top. And basically they came in 5-foot sections. And so you had to put them up 5 foot at a time. And then you would crank it up and you would winch them down. And then you would take the next section and winch it up. So we would actually erect them. But then we would also connect them to our radio vans, work the radio signals, bring in the signal, make sure it's shooting to another antenna. And actually link the communications link from the front lines to the
So it's still pretty old school then.
Oh, very old school.
Yeah.
Very old school. So got out of the military, went into law enforcement and firefighting at the same time. The firefighting was a volunteer basis. Anyone who's ever been in rural America, rural Indiana, especially in the Midwest, knows there's not a lot of paid fire departments. So the community kind of jumps on board and kind of helps out, and it's a volunteer basis. So I was a volunteer firefighter, as a paid police officer. Very much enjoyed being a police officer, but I found that there was more money in the private sector. So got pulled to the private sector doing private security and bodyguard work and private investigations. Did that until I met my current wife, who said, hey, I'm going to join the military, and she joined the Navy. And I said, great. And
she's an amazing woman, by the way.
She is an amazing woman. She's actually pregnant with our first child, so pretty excited about that. Thank you. In that time, between the time that I got out of the service and was doing law enforcement and the time that I met her, married her, and we moved out here, I got back into my love, my passion, which is baseball. And originally I got into it by coming back into it as an umpire. I had a couple friends who were umpires, and they said, hey, why don't you start umpiring with us? You can make some good money on the weekends. So I started that. Went down to the minor league umpire school, where you can become a professional minor league umpire and then work your way through the ranks to have an opportunity at the majors. Did well at the school, but figured out that their schedule was ridiculous and the pay was even worse. And so I said, thanks, but no thanks. I'm going home. And so I took my happy rear end back home. Got the opportunity through umpiring to meet and befriend Tracy Smith, who's a well-known Division I baseball coach. He got me into coaching, and so now ever since I've been doing coaching as kind of a side gig, and that's really my passion. And that's what, moved out here with my wife in the military, and now I'm coaching baseball out here.
And Tracy Smith has had a pretty illustrious career, too.
He's had a great career. For those that haven't heard the name Tracy Smith, he's the 2013 NCAA and ABCA Coach of the Year. He took Indiana University, who was not a storied program. Took him to the NCAA tournament twice, I believe, one of which going all the way to Omaha to the College World Series. And he now coaches at Arizona State and has a great facility over there and is working hard to bring that program back to what it once was, which is a championship program. Okay. So he is a very talented man. I'm very blessed to call him a friend and a mentor, and love to see him do well.
Sounds like he's got your back, too.
He does. He does. And I'm very grateful for that. And if it wasn't for him, I wouldn't have some of the opportunities that I have now. You know, coaching, like any profession, is a small community. And you're going to run into people along the way that either know people you've worked with or this or that. And so having somebody in my corner like a Tracy Smith, who, anyone in the baseball community knows across the country, I can kind of toss that name out there. And the fact that he has my back and picks it up and says, yeah, not only do I know him, the kid can coach,
it's a validation.
That helps, that's a big boost. And so he's gotten me into a lot of the places that I've gotten into.
Yeah.
So with a relationship like that and a guy who's had as much success as he had on, a really high level, what are, maybe a couple things he's told you or you've taken away from him that you've applied to, your success track?
I would be honest and say that 90% of my philosophy and how I coach comes from him. I mimic most of what he does on and off the field. And having said that, the one thing I learned from him is that he is real on, off the field, at a restaurant. You can approach him, sit down with him, have a conversation. If he doesn't know you, it doesn't matter. He'll sit there and he'll talk with you. And just being genuine, you know, that it, that goes a long way. And it helps with his recruiting. It helps with his ability to get the game across to players because he is who he is. You know, he still thinks he's a big kid. You know, here this guy's 50 years old and he's quarterbacking the intramural football team, you know, for the college because he's a big kid. But that's just who he is. That's him. He's real. He's a small town Midwest guy and he's never going to change that. And that is probably the biggest thing that I've taken from him and applied to myself is just be who you are and don't change that. You know, don't let your progression in your career change who you started as. So.
Now you've run into a couple of people too that I think like are very, very respectable and I would say like contextually beneficial to what you're doing now. You ran into Pete Rose in Vegas. In Vegas, can you elaborate on that story a little bit?
So, Pete Rose, first of all, lives in Vegas, does a lot of autograph signings in Vegas.
And you're a baseball coach, by the way.
I am. Yeah, I am. And I love baseball in general. I've always loved baseball. That's my sport. And so, running into the all-time hits leader for the game, I thought, hey, why not get something signed by the guy, you know? So, I got a baseball bat that was the kind of baseball bat he would have used when he was playing, had him sign it. And in doing so, I got a couple minutes to speak with him. And, you know, it was really neat. And I told him when I first sit down with him, you know, you're around all these people and they're all asking him questions and this and that. And I said, you know, I can ask you anything under the sun. I could sit here for hours with you and talk baseball or talk about the Hall of Fame or talk about your career or, you know, all of this. I have one question for you, though. And that is, as a coach, how do I make my hitters better? And he sat there for a second, kind of looked at me, looked back at the bat he was signing, and for a slight moment had me a little scared that he was going to knock me out of my chair. But, old Pete Rose, you know, he can hit well from what I hear. So then he looked back at me and he said, have him swing away. And I thought it was kind of a generic answer at first, and I was like, oh, okay, you know, whatever. And he said, no, he said, I'm serious. He said, today's hitters are way too picky. He said, I hit a lot of balls that weren't strikes. I hit a lot of pitches that weren't in the strike zone, but I hit them well. And I hit a bunch of pitches that were maybe not good pitches to swing at, but I hit them because I was swinging. Yeah. And they turned into hits, and I became the all-time hit leader. He said, don't let your guys get so distracted by where the strike zone is that they lock up and are afraid to swing the bat. Swing away.
Yeah, and now you being a baseball player and also now an umpire too, like does that essentially kind of help you out when you're doing umpire gigs now, when you're assessing the players and kind of going, you know, hey, are you looking for the strike zone? Are you fishing for balls? Are you, you know, things like that?
I have a very unique perspective because there are very few people who have done all three perspectives, you know, the player, the manager, and the umpire. And until you do all three, you don't realize the difference in perspective from each position. And it makes it a very unique spot for me to be in because now when I'm coaching and I'm managing a team, if I see a call that maybe another coach would run out on and argue until he got tossed, I know how to approach that situation and give the umpire an out because the umpires, in the high school game, you play 7 innings, so they're looking for 21 outs on either side, okay? Mm-hmm. They need those 21 outs on either side to get their paycheck. So they're always looking for an out. They're always looking for a way to get an out, okay? Because that's how they get paid. If they call safes, time goes on. Now, they don't want to screw people over or anything. That's not what I'm saying.
Sure.
But a lot of times, especially in a two-umpire system, what you have in high school, one umpire doesn't have a good angle to see the play. And he's the umpire that's supposed to be making the call. It's not his fault. It's not that he's out of position. It's not that he didn't get in the right spot. But sometimes the course of the game, it blocks the view. Yeah, it blocks the view of the umpire. And you have to call what you see.
Yeah.
When I go out to argue a call 90% of the time, that's what I'm going out to discuss. And I don't even call an argument because 90% of the time I go to him and I say, hey, you know, all I'm going to ask you to do, I think you made the right call from the angle that you're at. But all I'm going to ask you to do is ask for help from the other umpire because I think he had a better angle to see what I saw. And if you approach it like that, 90% of your umpires don't have a chip on your shoulder. They're going to go down to their partner. They're going to say, hey, what'd you see? The other partner's going to say, hey, yeah, he's right from my angle, man. He got punched out. Okay, cool. Boom. Yeah. Change the call. It changes the way I approach umpires from a coaching perspective. It also changes the way, as an umpire, I would approach coaches now. Before, I'm like, what's this guy yelling at? What, you know, gee, why is he all in my case? Well, because from the dugout, it changes the angle of the play. It changes the angle.
Absolutely.
Of the, and so he's not seeing what I'm seeing. And so, you know, a lot of times before, you would try to explain that to him. Hey, you're not. But he didn't want to hear that. He's upset. He's fired up. So now what I might do in that situation is say, hey, you know what? I'll take it up. My partner has the same kind of angle you do. I'll take it up with him. We'll discuss it real quick. And if he didn't see it that way, that's going to be that. Yeah. And maybe that would have diffused some more.
Well, with that, from a perspective of an umpire, you know, the Giants rookie, Chris Heston, threw a no-hitter last night. And what I wanted to ask is, when a situation like that is going on, especially in baseball, which is probably the most superstitious sport, when you are umpiring a game where a pitcher may have a no-hitter going or a perfect game going, do you then feel pressure as the umpire to make sure every call is perfect? How does that affect you calling a game?
Or is that even on your radar, I guess?
Here's the thing. It's on your radar. Okay. I mean, if you're an umpire, you know that nobody's been on base today.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, yeah. It's okay. We're in the seventh inning. Oh, cool. All right. Does it add pressure to you? Let me ask you this: if you had a lottery ticket in your hand and they had read the first five numbers, and the first five numbers are your numbers, and then that six number's hanging out there. I mean, even though you have no control over that final number, do you feel pressure at that point? Are you excited? Is your heart? That's what you get as an umpire.
Yeah.
Because as an umpire, I have a responsibility for that last ball in the lottery.
Yeah.
I have a responsibility that if I call the wrong number on that lottery ball, as we've seen in the past, I could screw up somebody's history. And so, yeah, it's a lot of pressure. The thing you have to do is you have to focus on, because it's like any other profession. You focus on your training. You control your breathing. You get in the slot. You get your head level right. You put your eyes where they're supposed to be, and you call what you see. And that's the only thing you can do. Because if you start to focus on it, if you start to worry about it, you know, oh, okay, if I miss this pitch, then he's gonna, I'm gonna mess up this guy's no hitter or this perfect game. Well, then you're going to, you're gonna screw it up. You know, our brains work in a way that if we think about it, it will come to fruition. You
Absolutely,
know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so you can't think, okay, don't blow this next pitch. Because then you're going to blow the next pitch. It's just going to happen. So you just have to stay focused on what you're doing and call what you see. Umpiring, and you know, you hear guys talk about, well, that umpire, he's just trying to call against the other team. Let me tell you, it's very difficult to do that, okay? Let's say a guy's throwing a 96-mile-an-hour fastball. That means you have 0.3 seconds from the time it leaves the pitcher's hand to the time it hits his mitt, okay? In that time, I've got to decide whether it's a ball or a strike, and I've got to call it. I don't have time in my head to go through the process of, okay, which team's pitching, which team. Okay, I want this guy to not have a strike, so I need to. I can't do it. It's impossible.
Yeah.
So I have to call what I see. I have to call the game as I see it.
It's physically impossible to compute an edge and induce it on it. Yeah,
absolutely.
On a game, yeah.
Absolutely. So to answer your question, yes, absolutely, you feel a lot of pressure and you take that moment and you think to yourself, don't screw this up. But at that very second, you step away, you clear yourself. You step back in, you do your job.
Yeah, I think, because that's super interesting to me, because I think baseball has one of the most subjective officiating systems.
Sure.
I think baseball and the NFL, I mean, the NBA to a point too. Yeah. NBA, absolutely. I think NBA. But baseball, I think that's when accomplishments like this, you only realize that there's a person calling those strikes, calling those outs when they mess up.
Right.
And nobody really gives a thought to, like, how do the umpires feel when it's the, you know, bottom of the eighth inning, there's a perfect game going? Because as fans, nobody wants to talk about it. Everyone's like, everyone knows what's going on. So, of course, the umpire knows. And how do they feel? Nobody ever asked that question.
I'm going to tell you, here's the funny thing, and this is talked about amongst umpires and officials in most sports across the board. Baseball is a game where we understand you're going to mess up. It's a game around the concept of you're going to screw up 3 out of every 4 times. Okay? let's face it. If a guy's batting 250, he's having a decent year. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's the way it is. Let me tell you, if an umpire blew 3 out of 4 calls,
you're done.
You would have absolute pandemonium. You would have a riot on the field. They are the most criticized and crucial parts of that game, and they make some of the most critical split-second decisions you could possibly ever make when you're talking about a profession. And you have to understand, this is a profession, so every pitch is worth millions of dollars to somebody. Yeah. Okay, every single pitch, every decision you make. That's why you'll see a lot of managers who come out and they'll argue calls. They'll argue from three calls before. Because if you'd have called that a strike, he wouldn't have got this next pitch that he hit for a home run and cost me three runs. So you just gave them three runs by calling the last pitch a ball when you shouldn't have called it a strike. And so every pitch is worth millions of dollars to somebody in that profession.
Yeah.
I'm curious because you have been a player, a manager, as well as an umpire, and to your point of the importance of every call that an umpire makes and the introduction of technology into baseball, you know, which we've seen this year with the replays coming into effect, you know, now every home run can be reviewed. What are your thoughts on technology into baseball? Because it does seem to be like the last sport to kind of embrace this and to take it on.
Well, I want to say, first of all, I want to say thank you to football, who was the first to undergo this and say, you know what, we're going to take a chance and we're going to put this in and we're going to see how it works. Because if they don't take that chance, then it doesn't progress to the point where we're even having this discussion about baseball. And let me tell you, as an official on the field, you never want to be the reason. You know, the officials will tell you, the best game I ever did is the one nobody knew I was there.
Yeah,
it's right. It's plain and simple.
Yep.
We know we're an essential part of the game, but you don't ever want to be an essential part of the game. You want the game to call itself, essentially. And so you never want to be the reason why something happened or something didn't happen. We know that we have to make that judgment call. We know somebody has to be able to make that judgment call. We get it. But there's not an umpire out there who wants to tell you, I look forward to making that wrong call. No, that's just not true. You know what I mean? So integrating review into the sport is only going to be good for the sport. I mean, there's nobody out there that wants the wrong call to stand. You know what I mean? Not the umpires, not the managers, not the players, not the fans. There's nobody that wants that wrong call to be the one that decides the game. Or to go back and say, you know, well, maybe we win the World Series if this call goes this way. Or maybe we win, you know, Game 7 of the NBA Finals if the call goes this way. Nobody wants to have that on their conscience. Everybody would much rather go, hey, the ball was foul, okay? It didn't hit the pole. It went around, you know what I mean? It went in front of it and went foul. We would much rather have that conclusive. So to say that, I am very excited about putting review into baseball. Having said that, part of the sport is the element of human error. That's why I don't think you will more than likely ever see, you know, balls and strikes or anything of that nature ever being called, because that's just literally a part of the game. And you have to understand that as a player, as an umpire, as a coach. And so if you ever took that element out, I think it would hurt the game. You know what I mean?
It would mechanize it.
It would. Really would. Yeah. And so I love that we're integrating more reviews into the game. I think there's still some room, wiggle room, both ways that we can work with the review and fix it in certain ways. But I think it's a great thing. I think it's something that should have been done 20 years ago.
Strike zone, though, should be umpire's call.
Strike zone's got to be umpire's discretion.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's no way another official could ever make a comment on another umpire's strike zone. And I think you mentioned football kind of leading the way. And I know one big con that people like to talk about instant replay is the amount of time referees and umpires take now to review calls. Announcers will say, well, why are you taking so much time? Like I think we saw in the NBA Finals game last night, where they were reviewing a call and it took like 5 minutes to figure out what was going on. The referees didn't know. They spent so much time reviewing. And I think that the NFL is doing something that hockey has actually done for about 10 years since they've, or 15 years since they instituted instant replay, where they're not having the officials at the game review instant replay. They're contacting the central office in New York, where there is a paid official who's doing nothing but watching every single angle they have. And I think that is where I think baseball will ultimately move on to, of having a separate official watching every game, or a group of officials who are going to be called up. Hey, what's the call? Was it a home run? Was it a foul? And they can rule. And it takes that, again, then you're removing the
the burden off those officials who were then there in the game.
Actually,
and have to do with that.
Baseball, okay. That's how baseball already does their reviews.
Is that
baseball? Just... Baseball goes to a for Major League. It's in New York. They Perfect. Call it a central location. There are at any time two legal umpires in that room that basically have every camera angle in that you can see on TV, and they will review it from every possible angle that they have, and they make the call, and then they simply radio it down to people that are there and tell them what it is. College baseball this year, it was the first year for review in college baseball, and they have it only had it in the tournament. And I watched the game just the other day. I can't recall who was playing now, unfortunately, but the shot was right down the line, and it was in the 12th inning of a great game going back and forth. It was right down the third baseline, and the question was, did it hit the foul pole and flare off, or did it miss the foul pole and flare off on its own? And that was it. The initial call was home run. They go to the review, and the funny thing is, the commentators were talking about, you know, this call is not being made by the umpires that are here now on the field. It's being made by an official in a central location.
Some other
It is, but they only have the camera angles that are available to you guys. They don't have, you know, and that's one of the problems with the NFL. They can only see one angle on that screen at a time when they go in behind the curtain.
Right.
You know, yeah. It takes forever. Well, the guys back in the studio or the guys back in the central office, they've got these plasma screens all over the place that they can see six angles at once and go, okay, I'm looking here. There's the catch. There's the tag. His hand isn't to the bag yet. Okay, he's out. It's a simple call. You see what I'm saying? And so it does make the process so much faster. And I think it's a great thing. And I think everybody should go to that process.
Yeah. It's funny to think that baseball, as much as we thought baseball is behind the mark on reviews and everything, they're actually somewhat ahead of the game, too. When you've got a booth that actually can review that, NFL hasn't done that.
You have to understand, baseball was such against review for the longest time because baseball is America's pastime that is a gentleman's game from the very start, you know, and so any type of change in baseball is you know, that's why you have stadiums like Wrigley
Field.
Everybody's apprehensive. That's why, yeah, absolutely. They don't want to change the game. That's why still one league has a designated hitter and one league doesn't, because they don't want to change the game.
Yep.
And so, you know, when you talk about change in baseball, it comes against opposition more times than not. When they did make the change to do the review, though, they said, okay, how can we make this better than what's already out there? And that was the great thing, is they said, okay, we don't like change, but if we're going to change it, let's do it right. Let's make it fast. Because people, let's face it, people already complain about MLB games going 3.5-4 hours. Right. You know what I mean? Nobody wants to sit there and watch a 3.5-4 hour game if you're not an avid baseball person. And so having reviews in it, drag it on that much longer, is not going to be beneficial to anybody.
Yeah.
But if you can make them quick and you can make them precise, and it's as simple as the manager just walks to the top step, he hears from his review team, yes, we're going to challenge it. He signals to the umpire now. Used to, that was the other thing. That's the other thing they changed. Used to, he had to go start an argument with the umpire, wait on his review team to give him the nod, and then say, oh, by the way, we want to review this. You know, now they don't have to do that. They just come to the top step.
It's a cordial process.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Now they come to the top step. They say, hey, and the guys, everybody waits. Nobody leaves the field. Yes, we're going to review it. They go review it. And before the guys even get on the headset, they're already reviewing it in the office, and they say, yes, he's out. Okay, boom. Done. Everybody leaves the field. We play ball.
Yeah.
What's funny about that is I remember, I think, the beginning of last season, so the first year it was implemented, whenever that was, either last season or season before, I was listening to a Padres game on the radio, and I think it may have been one of the first regular season calls for a replay review, and they wouldn't give it to Bud Black because they said he took too long to ask for it. And what's funny is because Ted Leitner's calling it, had no idea that there was a time limit on when you could ask for a replay review.
Yeah.
So it's funny that they've gotten the kinks worked out and everybody's on it and the timing works better. Because, I mean, when it comes to baseball, I think the other thing that kind of irks me when you say that, when people say that baseball is kind of stuck in the past, is when it comes to Hall of Fame voting. And real quick, I just want to ask, you talked about Pete Rose. So this is, I know
he
it's not.
Be
okay. You already beat me
there. I don't listen. Undisputably, Pete Hall is a part of baseball history. I don't care how you put it. He is a part of baseball history. He did not cheat. He broke a rule. Okay?
Yeah.
So if you're going to put the guys, or if you're even going to allow the guys that have used PEDs and up their stats by doing that, if you're going to allow them to be voted on to be in the Hall, then Pete Rose, who is a part of baseball history and has the most hits of any player who's ever played the game, he should most definitely be in the Hall of Fame.
That is somebody that has had all three perspectives of the game, too. I think that somewhat legitimizes that claim beyond just a fan level, which I've had for a lot of time.
And I say, put Pete Rose in the Hall of Fame. So he doesn't have to make shitty Skecher commercials about not being in the Hall.
And he can purchase a real haircut.
Yes. I think that hurts me years. That Pete Rose is reduced to making a very poorly made Skechers commercial because he deserves
way more than that. I'm not going to lie. Pete not being in the Hall of Fame has made Pete a lot of money post-baseball.
Oh, absolutely.
Here's the thing. A lot of athletes, after they leave their sport, don't have any way to make that money. You know what I mean? They get forgotten about. They become irrelevant. Okay, Pete Rose, for 20 years, hasn't been irrelevant. Okay? He's still signing autographs in Las Vegas every Saturday afternoon because he's still very relevant, and he's still making very good money on that.
I can't mention one game that I've seen him play, yet every time that he's mentioned, I'm watching it. Absolutely. I'm looking for it.
I think the best opposite example of how not to do it is Jose Canseco, because that's how you don't want to stay relevant.
Celebrity boxing matches.
Trying to snitch on people who may have or may have not actually done something.
You had a baseball bounce off your head and go make it a home run. So, I mean, you're officially done at that point as an outfielder if you're Jose Canseco. Yeah. So.
Well, because you're just done as a person if your name is Jose Canseco.
Yeah, that's true, too.
Didn't he have his brother try and fight for him in one of those stupid celebrity boxing matches, too?
Again. If you see what Jose Canseco has done with his life, do the opposite, and you're off to a great start.
Yeah. I think that was a great episode, though. We're going to wrap it up.
Thank you, Greg.
Greg, thank you so much for coming on. That was a great episode. Thank you for the interview. Thank you for all your feedback and everything like that. I knew it was going to be awesome. So, thanks for coming on, brother.
Anytime.
And you're out of here.
Rose into the Hall of Fame, damn it.
4,000 hits. Get him in.
Yeah. And we just want to plug...
Looking forward into the future.
Yeah, looking forward in the future. Still have our new Podbean website, popnotsoda.podbean.com. We also are officially on Point and Yell Productions at pointandyell.com. Check out Adam Connie. He's producing our stuff. Twitter handles. Dan, you want to take that away?
Yeah, as always, you can follow me at Dan_Perez_. You can follow Brett at niecespieces. Brian, we are not following at Vagina Busters, so you can follow anything Brian wants to say at pop_not_soda on Twitter.
And we're starting to get like a big pull now. We've been streaming some videos, we've been doing some things, we've been getting a lot of listeners. If anybody wants to email us or tweet us to have us talk about a subject or
our email,
answer questions,
email, as Brett has mentioned, popnotsodaofficial@gmail.com. Please follow along with our Twitch streams. Today we played You Don't Know Jack and Drawful.
And there's some pretty drawful illustrations. Terrible.
Yeah. Actually, we invited Greg in for the last quarter of it. And
I did not know how to play.
It spruced it up that much more.
It gets very messy towards the end. Looking forward to future episodes next week. We have another guest, if I'm not mistaken.
Absolutely.
We may have plugged him earlier in the show. One very degenerate Ryan Shores will be on Pop Not Soda for the first time next week. So make sure you don't miss that.
And is he?
And it's.
I heard he has marshmallows.
Oh, he does have marshmallows. And he's pre-roast, too, so we might catch him before he gets a complex.
Yeah, while he still has any self-esteem left.
Absolutely. So.
He will be on our show. So again, as always, we have been Pop Not Soda, your weekly sits pat of pop culture.
Greg, thank you for coming on.
Thank you guys.
To Greg Atkinson, and we will see you guys next week.
R.I.P. Paul Walker.
Son of a bitch.